It's Sunday, the 22nd of November, 2015, the 10th of Kislev 5776, and on 558 AM, digital radio, online, and as a podcast. This is Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. I'm Phil Dave. Coming up, the singer who's been called the Jewish Nora Jones, Rachel Sage, will be performing this week in Camden. To find out about her forthcoming gig and about her work, she's been speaking to Kate Fulton. Hear what happened in about 25 minutes' time. Our top story on Sunday Jewish Radio this week is about the terrorist attacks in Paris, which, as we shall hear in the news with Philip in just a moment, left members from all religious communities shocked and saddened by the loss of friends and loved ones. I'll be speaking to Robert Edgenez from CRIF, that's the French equivalent of the Board of Deputies. And on Roundtable this week, the subject of terrorism, as the world appears to rally round and support the French in their retaliation efforts towards the so-called Islamic State. Clive Roslin and Adam Bradley will ask their guests, volunteer extraordinaire Andrea Lucas and actor and photographer Tony Honigberg, why is it that if France responds to terrorist organisations, it's okay, but not when Israel does? That's guaranteed to be very thought-provoking, I'm sure. And later on, we have a big announcement to make here at Sunday Jewish Radio, so please do stick around for that as well. But before all of that, with a roundup of the Jewish news stories from the past week, here's Philip Chrysikos.
The French and Jewish community was united in grief this week with their fellow countrymen and women following the terror attacks recently, which left 129 people dead and hundreds more wounded. It's being put down to Friday night tradition as the reason why there weren't more Jewish-related casualties, but among the victims was Damilia Reibenberg, the wife of Gregory Reibenberg, the majority share owner of the Café La Belle Équipe, and Justine Moulon, the granddaughter of Professor David Rutzi. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel has solidarity with France against militant Islamic terrorism. Shortly after the attacks, part of Jerusalem's Old City Wall was illuminated with a French tricolour. Whilst here in the UK, during an address at the annual Norwood dinner, London Mayor Boris Johnson gave a stark warning about potentially thousands of people in London who would mean us harm, going on to say that the fight against the so-called Islamic State is understood by every Jewish person, whether at home or abroad. This week, the chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, led a delegation of United Synagogue rabbis to a Greek refugee camp to learn about the human cost of the international refugee crisis. Among the rabbis who accompanied him were Rabbi Diane Ivan Binstock of St. John's Wood, Rabbi Borog Baldovsky of Elstree and Boreham Wood Synagogue, and Rabbi Danny Bergson of Pinner Synagogue. The rabbis visited Camp Idiomi on Greece's northern border, where up to 10,000 migrants pass through every day. Rabbi Mervis said he was enormously proud of the life-saving contribution made by the British Jewish community. Pope Francis will make his first official visit to Rome's Great Synagogue at the beginning of next year. According to a statement by the city's Jewish community, he'll be the third pope to have visited the venue, which is scheduled to take place on the 17th of January. Last month, in his most recent meeting with Jewish leaders, Pope Francis affirmed that attacking Jews and attacking Israel are both anti-Semitic. Akiva School has been ranked in the top 20 state primaries in the UK, following a recent table in the Sunday Times. The school has said it is proud to be 14th in the country out of 200. The head teacher, Susie Stone, said the ranking places them as the highest performing Jewish primary nationally and paid tribute to their lovely children, the support of their parents, and the dedication of a superb team of staff and governors. And finally, a Manchester-based rabbi has claimed he believes it is in order for Jewish supporters to attend a Friday night football match because the ground falls within the North Manchester Erov. The match, which will see Salford City meet Hartlepool in a second-round tie on Friday the 4th of December, will be at Moor Lane in Salford. Rabbi Arnold Saunders says although it's arguable it's not within the spirit of Shabbat, he has known rabbonim to go to a football match on Shabbat before. And that's the news this week.
Thank you, Philip. It's that time now when Diana Toman joins me, Clive Roslin, in the studio to review this week's Jewish newspapers. Diana, first the front pages, as usual.
I'm looking at the front page of the Jewish News, Clive, which has a very poignant little picture of a Yahrzeit candle standing all by itself, and the candle flame is in the colours of the tricolour, blue, white and red, and above that is just a simple little line which says, long V, long life.
It's very moving.
Very moving. And if I turn over the page to page two, it goes into, obviously, all the aftermath of the Paris attacks. It says, France's Jewish community is united in grief with their fellow countrymen and women in the wake of last Friday's terror attacks, which left 129 people dead and hundreds more wounded. The predominantly Sephardi Paris Jewish community is traditional, and its young people more often spent Friday nights at home with their families, which may well have led to the few Jewish-related casualties in the carnage. That's interesting, isn't it? I hadn't thought of it from that point of view. Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis signed a book of condolence at the French Embassy in London on Tuesday and spoke to his counterpart, the French Chief Rabbi Chaim Korsia, after the attacks.
Well, the Jewish Chronicle has got obviously the same subject as its first page, but it's a big, beautiful picture of all the refugees coming through Greece and other places. And it reads, I saw genuine refugees pass this gate. Months earlier, Paris gunmen had been among them. And inside, on page two of the Jewish Chronicle, there's an exclusive which says, the mastermind behind the Paris attacks used this makeshift Greek checkpoint to move through Europe, posing as a refugee. And last week, Rowan Doherty visited the same checkpoint, and her report is inside.
Now, on page four, you will have heard Philip in the news referring to Boris Johnson's speech at the Norwood dinner last Monday. And he said, plots to attack the UK are foiled virtually every month, and there are thousands of people in London who could mean us harm. That was the stark warning from Boris Johnson during a speech to Norwood's annual dinner, in which he described the fight against Islamic State as a war, which would be fought as much in the internet chat rooms of London as in Syria. The Mayor of London received rapturous applause following his visit to Israel last week, but his opening remarks in the wake of the attacks in France stood in contrast to the jokes and upbeat atmosphere of that trip. The work of Norwood in helping the disabled was a shining example of the stark difference in values between the West and ISIS, which would treat those aided by the charity with brutality, Boris Johnson said.
The Jewish Chronicle's got an interesting article, which is still on the same subject, really, is headed, Welcome to Molenbeek, the jihadi nest at the heart of Europe. And it says that the neighbourhood in western Brussels has become the focus of attention for European security services in the wake of the Paris attack. And it has emerged, as probably we have all heard now on television and radio and in the newspapers, that the suburb of Molenbeek served as a planning and logistics base for the jihadis. And it's also the area where other terrorists who carried out recent attacks in France and Belgium found a haven and acquired weapons. And a series of police raids took place in the suburb this week, where it is estimated that at least a third of the 100,000 residents are Muslims of Moroccan and Turkish origin. And Salah Abdeslam, one of the suspected Paris attackers, lived in the neighbourhood along with his brother Ibrahim, who was killed in the attack when he exploded the suicide vest he was wearing. And it's a very, I could say, almost depressing article. Well, yes. It is a depressing article.
Yes, I feel so. How many did you say? One third of the residents are.
Yeah,
are
yes.
One wonders what the other two thirds of the residents feel about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, this is an extraordinary story, actually, in the Jewish Chronicle about Sweden's Foreign Minister Margot Wallström linking the attacks to the Middle East conflict with the situation in the Middle East. The thrust of the article is that she says that we have reason, she told a Swedish TV station, we have reason to be worried, not just in Sweden, but across the world, because there are so many that are being radicalised. Here, once again, she says, we are brought back to situations like the one in the Middle East, where not least the Palestinians see that there is not a future. We must either accept a desperate situation or resort to violence. Now, as you can imagine, the Israeli foreign minister reacted very angrily to that and immediately issued a statement saying, those who engage in hopeless attempts to link the terror attacks by Islamic extremists with the difficulties between Israelis and Palestinians are misleading themselves, as well as the public opinion of their country and the international community. The Swedish minister is systematically biased and one-sided against Israel. You wouldn't have expected that from Sweden.
Well, also, you wouldn't expect it from a Swedish minister either.
No.
You'd expect a little more, I don't know quite what to say.
You'd expect a little more circumspection,
exactly,
wouldn't you?
Exactly. Well, here's something to cheer us up on that same subject, I suppose, because the Jewish News says that Hilary Benn, who's a shadow minister in the Labour Party, Hilary Benn has told Labour Friends of Israel, take on those who delegitimise Israel. The comments he made came during Labour Friends of Israel's informal lunch in Westminster, during which he also spoke personally about his family's links to the country. He hailed the Jewish state as a high-tech centre with a vibrant democracy, adding, our future relations must be built on cooperation and engagement, not Israel of Israel. We must take on those who seek to delegitimise the state of Israel or question its right to exist. And also, it says, this is interesting, he didn't refer directly to the boycott campaign, although Labour has previously expressed opposition to general and academic boycotts of Israel. His appearance came amid ongoing concerns over Jeremy Corbyn's long-term criticism of Israel, expressions of support for arms and economic measures against Israel, and description of Hamas and Hezbollah as friends. So that's quite encouraging, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I didn't realise his family had
links to
Israel.
I once had the great pleasure of interviewing Tony Benn some few years ago, obviously, and he, at the time, told me how much he loved the Jews and how he loved Israel.
Really? That is interesting. Well, following that article, this one is in the Jewish News, Justin Cohen is writing about the number of Israelis moving to Britain, which apparently has outstripped the number of Brits making Aliyah by 3-2, based on statistics from the 2011 census. The population of the Israelis has grown by 350% in the 4 decades since 1971, and 4% annually after 2011. However, it still represents just 6% of the overall Jewish community here. And he goes on to say, while relatively few belong to a shul, they are just as likely as British Jews to send their children to Jewish schools. Given that this is quite a young population, the majority aged between 25 and 45, and highly educated, Israelis could well represent an incredibly valuable pool of talent for the Jewish community if they become active in British Jewish life.
Oh, that's interesting. Hmm. And there's a lovely story in the Jewish Chronicle, which is headed, East End Synagogue is sold to its Muslim neighbours. And the sale of an old East End synagogue to a neighbouring mosque has been hailed as an example of positive relations between Jews and Muslims, says the JC. It's Fieldgate Street Great Synagogue, which shut earlier this year, and it's been bought by the adjacent East London Mosque, the largest in the country. And Judge Khurshid Brabu, a trustee of the Joseph Interfaith Foundation, noted that the synagogue had given their Muslim brothers next door first option on the building. And a few years ago, the mosque gave a grant to the Federation of Synagogues Congregation towards repairs. And the judge said the mosque's trustees were now considering keeping that synagogue as a mark of heritage for Jewish people and to use the centre for scholastic exchange for people from different faiths. Isn't that lovely?
That's very heartwarming.
It's very heartwarming, and it's a good way to end this particular news review. Diana, thank you. Thank you very much. Our top story on Sunday Jewish Radio this week is about the terrorist attacks in Paris, which, as we heard in the news with Philip, left members from all religious communities shocked and saddened by the loss of friends and loved ones. And Phil Dave has been speaking to Robert Egenez, the executive director from CRIF. That's the French equivalent of the Board of Deputies. And Phil started by asking Robert how the mood in France is now 1 week on from the attacks.
For once, I would say the Jewish community is totally part of the national community. And the feeling in the Jewish community is the very same that everybody in France is feeling, a feeling of sorrow, feeling of wrath somehow against the terrorist, against the jihadist terrorist who have killed in Paris without any selection of people, Jews, Christians, Muslims, blacks, whites, and young people, essentially, and really a feeling of wariness also, because we know it may not be finished and it may come back.
Well, I think what's really striking about this particular incident, and yes, of course, we all remember the terrorist attacks here in London in 2005. We all remember the terrorist attacks in 2001 in America. But what's really, really poignant about this seems to have really struck a chord with everybody. As you say, the terrorists didn't discriminate. They weren't choosing any particular target. It was people from all backgrounds were the victims of. And it feels as if this has almost united all religions when we didn't sort of think that could ever really be possible somehow.
That's right. And they were essentially young people. So that struck the population even more. That's number one. And the other difference is these capacity in London, in New York, it was planes crashing in the towers. In London, it was a bomb. We have had bombs in Paris in 1995, but this is the first time that people kill at blank point and or by exploding themselves. And so it's also a difference, because terrorists today are not hiding, but they're not afraid of dying. And this makes it even more dangerous.
And also, I think that the other thing that terrorists have almost been implying that they are afraid of more is the ability for peace and love and harmony to reign over terror, which probably makes them even more determined in some horrible way. Would you say that France has been comforted, not only just the Jewish community, but obviously France as a whole, would you say has been more comforted by the outpouring from all over the world? I mean, obviously, Prime Minister Netanyahu has pledged his support from Israelis, and also obviously David Cameron here, you've had Barack Obama. Has that helped such a horrible time, would you say?
Definitely, definitely. It came from all over the world, into the nation, but also in the Jewish community. It's amazing the number of calls, the number of messages, of letters that we have received from Jewish communities all around the world for support, and this is very important to us. It's very important for France. And also, I would add, the speeches from the political parties have been very united. The speech from the president of the Republic has been very consensual, but also like the singing of the Marseillaise all over the world and in Wembley are acts that really touch the heart of the French people in their sorrow.
And also, I think that there's reports that are suggesting that the reason why the Jewish community, although it has been affected quite badly by this, the effect must be on the whole of France, but if we take a moment to look at the Jewish community in particular, they're saying that the reason why it wasn't as badly affected as it could have been is because it took place on a Friday evening. Is there any truth in that? Was it thanks almost to Shabbat that the Jewish casualties weren't as great a number as they could have been?
No. First of all, the Jewish casualties are more important than the portion of the Jews in the French nation, because we count, I've no exact count, but we know of at least four or five Jews that were killed in the bombing. Therefore, the proportion of Jews is quite important, considering the 1% representation of the Jewish population in France. And no, I don't think this is true. I think they really wanted to harm France at the heart, and with no consideration for religion or no consideration for religion. And Jews have paid the price. Remember that in January, in Hyper Kasher, people were killed because they were Jews. It was not Jews killed by, and there were Jews also at Charlie, but the ones we consider with more emphasis were the Jews killed because they were Jews. Same in Toulouse and same with Ilan Halimi in 2006. So the history of the killing of Jews is quite impressive in this country. Also, we were very concerned because every time there has been a killing, there has been, like Mera, when he killed in Toulouse, had killed French military forces before he went to the school to kill Jews. And there is also, always there has been a second shot towards the Jewish community. So we were very concerned, we raised the level of security in all the synagogues on Shabbat, because we were afraid that something may happen targeted directly to the Jewish community.
So what with the Hyper Kasher markets that obviously was attacked back in January, along with the Charlie Hebdo attack, and all of the horrific terrorism that France has had to endure in this year, it must have had a bit of an impact on the Jewish community, because am I right in thinking there's around about 6,000 Jews over the last year alone who have made Aliyah to try and, for want of a better term, escape the perils of potentially living in France?
You're not wrong in thinking this, but you have to give it more thought. First of all, the Jewish Aliyah has always been between 1 and 2,000. Up to 2013, were jumped to 3,500. Last year in 2014, it moved up to 7,000, and everything leads us to believe that the number will be higher in 2015. Now, the reason are not only related to anti-Semitism. There is always a part of the people who make Aliyah for the good reasons, i.e. for positive ideological, religious reasons that leads them to want to live in Israel with their families or after their studies for the young people.
What do you think the future holds for French Jews?
Now, the question is, after Mera in 2012 in Toulouse, yes, there have been a lot of families that started thinking or moving forward their intention to go to Israel. So we may have, and we don't know for the moment, if the numbers of 2014 and 15 are essentially people who had the intention to move to Israel in the coming years and have forwarded their decision, or whether it's a real movement of people leaving France. The people who leave France now and go to Israel have several considerations. One is the economic situation. Obviously, the economic situation in Israel is easier than in Europe at the moment, especially in France. Second, as I said, the religious considerations. Because of what's happening in France, because of this laïcité debate, it's more difficult today than it was a few years ago for Jewish student to be assured that he will be able to take the exams on other days than Shabbat or on the holidays. a lot of exams have happened on Shavuot and Pesach, and therefore people who want to make sure that they will be able to follow up their studies may want to go somewhere else. And also the fact to live as a Jew, the level of anti-Semitism expressed by the level of, by the number of aggressions has been very high in the past 2 years. And that also lead people to move out of France. On the other hand, what we hear from the officials, from government officials, from opposition officials, is that, as the Prime Minister Manuel Valls said, France without the Jews would not be France anymore. Or the President Hollande, who said at the Crypt dinner last year, it's not the Jews that should leave France, it's the anti-Semites. Or François Baroin from the opposition, who said, if you ask the question of the future of the Jews of France, you are asking the question of the future of France. So they're very concerned about Jews leaving. And last consideration, the numbers that are published by the Jewish agency only concern the Jews that are leaving France to settle in Israel. Another number which is very concerning for the authorities and for the Jews is the number of French people who decide to move somewhere else and move out of France. And if you consider that London has become the fourth French town by population, it says something and nothing about the Jews. The fact that the French people are moving out of France and settled somewhere else. The number of French people in Los Angeles, in New York, in Miami, in Montreal, having increased immensely. The same for the Far East, for Shanghai, for Beijing, for Australia. And all this gives us information which is very important and do not concern only Jews.
Robert Ejnez, the executive director from CRIF, that's the French equivalent to the Board of Deputies, about last week's terrorist attacks, which left 129 people dead and hundreds more injured. Don't forget, if you would like to comment on any of the stories that you hear on Sunday Jewish Radio, you are welcome to do so. You can email us on studio@sundayjewishradio.co.uk, and we can also be contacted via social media. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/Sunday Jewish Radio, and on Twitter we are @SundayJRadio. Now, Rachel Sage is a New York-based singer-songwriter who's been called the Jewish equivalent of Norah Jones, a high compliment indeed, in my opinion. She's performing at the Green Note in Camden this coming Wednesday, the 25th of November. Kate Fulton has been catching up with Rachel ahead of her next London date, and she asked her how it came about that she was compared with Norah Jones.
Well, I think that quote came from a New York newspaper when I did my show around this holiday season, actually. It was called Tchotchkes and Latkes, and it was a holiday review and a very festive affair at New York City's Joe's Pub. And they just seemed to feel that my sense of humor combined with my musical antics put me in that vein. But, you know, I haven't been called that since, so it might have been a one-off sort of a thing.
You're a visual artist and you're an actress, and you are also a writer, is that right?
Well, my number one primary passion by far, by leaps and bounds, is music. I've been a musician for as long as I can remember, since I was 2.5 or 3 years old. And I have also dabbled in all of those other things and continue to do so. But they've all sort of revolved around music as the focal point, including when I was a ballet dancer at the School of American Ballet in my youth. But it was always the music and the classical music I heard every day in class that really sort of bound me to my future and my present at the moment.
So take us back then to your childhood, your youth. You were brought up in New York?
I was brought up in a suburb of New York. I was born in Port Chester, New York, and I've lived in a handful of other places, roughly an hour or so from the city. So I always had one foot in New York City, and I certainly always knew that I was going to move there and pursue a life in the arts. And my parents were reasonably encouraging. You know, when I say reasonably, it was because academics always came first. So if I was going to be involved in any artistic extracurricular, such as dance or, you know, music or theater, it could never be at the expense of, you know, doing well, you know, with my grades in school. And that was our deal. And I did my best to do right by their expectations and occasionally slipped up. But in the end, the arts won.
And did you have a Jewish background? We brought up, was it religious?
Yes. I was raised conservative Jewish, and I attended a synagogue called Temple Shalom, and I was bat mitzvah there. And, you know, I fondly think of it as really, it was not only my Jewish coming out, but, you know, my creative one as well. And, you know, I was a bit of a Hebrew school nerd. I wasn't cool because I really, really was into it. And I made good friends with the cantor and the rabbi, and they had a little bit of a teacher's pet in me, which, of course, didn't sit well with my peers. But the bottom line was the music turned me on, the studying the Torah, all of it. I really loved the challenge intellectually of trying to reconcile, you know, various texts with our daily life and trying to make it relevant somehow to me, because I wasn't really raised by very religious parents. But they were extremely focused on the importance of heritage and specifically tzedakah and trying
to
integrate
that. Did you sing?
That.
Did you have a bat mitzvah? Did you sing?
I did. I had a bat mitzvah, and it really was my first concert debut. So I kind of went above and beyond, and I did my Haftorah portion, but I also did the Torah portion, and I led the entire service pretty much and kind of kicked the cantor out. But he had a good laugh about it. He kept saying every week, "You want to learn something else? You want to lead this prayer too?" And I was like, "Sure, sounds fun. Why not?" You know, it was very empowering for me. And I think it really kind of kickstarted my sense of feeling that connection to not only singing and spirituality and how powerful a combination that could be, but also my identity and becoming comfortable sharing that on a pulpit or a stage, you know, wherever the case may be.
It was wonderful first stage.
Oh, it was great.
Did you have a musical family? Did they encourage you into music?
You know, ironically, I really didn't. My father is literally clinically tone deaf. Like, you know, you sing him happy birthday and he cannot repeat it back to you. It's very endearing. You know, it's a good party trick because no one can really believe that someone can actually be that tone deaf, but he is. And my mother can carry a tune well enough, you know, but neither of them are musicians. And I was just very blessed that they had a piano in the living room in spite of that. And they did encourage both of their daughters to try to take to it. It only stuck on me. My sister, you know, had some piano lessons and didn't really dig it, but I came to it much more organically. I started playing by ear at a very young age, and it became my best friend. So
this singing happy Jewish little girl went on to, did you go to drama school?
Well, a little bit of an oversimplification, but I think a lot of times I was singing because I was sad. You know, I would come home from school and someone would have picked on me. I was a little bit bullied, like many young girls are, and I would come home and I could play the piano and it would make me feel better. So
when did you decide to make that a permanent career?
Pretty young. You know, I saw examples of pop artists on television on things like Solid Gold and American Bandstand or whatever else. And I really related to that. I can remember thinking very matter-of-factly, you know, at a young age, well, of course, I'm going to do that. You know, like it was sort of a no-brainer for me. And it was convincing everyone else around me that somehow made sense or was a reasonable expectation. That was a bit more of an uphill climb.
Were you writing your own music at this time?
I was. And, you know, I started out composing on electronic instruments like synthesizers and drum machines when that technology availed itself. And it was around the time of my bat mitzvah that a very, very savvy uncle, he gathered my relatives together and they decided instead of giving me, you know, some traditional type of present, that they would give me a 4-track tape recorder. So that was my bat mitzvah gift. And in the beginning, you know, I kind of rolled my eyes at it. I didn't understand it. I wasn't very technologically inclined. But once I figured it out and I realized that you could multi-track and you could kind of fancy yourself, you know, a little producer and start learning all the lessons from Beatles records and everything else I could get my hands on and how to use those layering techniques, I was pretty absorbed by it.
Sounds good. So fast forward then, where's your career taken you?
Well, thankfully, it's taken me across the pond, and I've been in the UK many, many times now. I consider it my home away from home. I've done a variety of tours with everyone from, you know, contemporary opera singers to rock and roll acts and folk singers like Judy Collins. You know, it's been a wild ride and a privilege, really, to have the opportunity to get up on stage and share not only, you know, my kind of emotional expression with people, but to also be able to create that kind of community across all different cultural boundaries and help them disappear every night, you know, for an hour or two.
And who are your, at the moment, your musical inspirations?
Oh, I have so many, but, well, you know, I mentioned Judy Collins, and I was not raised by parents who kind of were in touch with the folk music of the 60s and 70s. They just sort of missed it somehow, and they were more into doo-wop and rock and roll. But she has been such a wonderful mentor to me, and recently she was willing to sing on my record. So she's been a wonderful inspiration, and I've been getting more into her music. I also run a record label called Empress Records out of New York City, and we have a handful of artists that we've signed and we're nurturing who continually inspire me. And one of them is actually a band of brothers called A Fragile Tomorrow. And the twins that front the band, they happen to be physically challenged and they have cerebral palsy and they have defied all kinds of incredible odds physically and, you know, on a variety of levels. And they've become this amazing rock band and they just finished doing a huge tour with Indigo Girls in the United States. So
sounds
very
good.
Inspiring.
And tell us what brings you to London this time.
I've been going back and forth between London and Germany and Netherlands, but my next gig there is at the Green Note, and that is the day before American Thanksgiving. That's how I remember it. It's November 25th, and the Green Note is just a charming, intimate listening room where a lot of Americana and folk artists play, and I'm a bit of a hybrid stylistically myself. You know, a little pop, a little folk, a little Americana.
Sounds great.
And excited to be back in that room again.
If listeners would like to come and hear you, well, how do they get tickets? How do they come?
Well, I think the easiest thing to do is to visit my website, which is rachelsage.com. And if you go to rachelsage.com/shows, all of the information is linked there on the show's page and ticket info and all kinds of other stuff. So yeah, check it all out. Or you can find me on Facebook or Instagram, Twitter, all of those things.
Well, I hope the concert goes well, and
thank
we look
you.
Forward to coming to hear you.
Thank you. I'm actually going to be debuting a Hanukkah song that I wrote called Hanukkah in the Village at that concert. So that'll be
to
a
that.
Lot of fun, too.
Excellent. Thank you, Rachel.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you
thank
for having
you.
Me.
Rachel Sage talking to Kate Fulton there. And if you would like more information on her forthcoming performance at the Green Note in Camden, it's this coming Wednesday, the 25th of November, then you can go to the website that Rachel's just mentioned. That's, of course, rachelsage.com. Or if you want, you can go to our Facebook page where you will find all the details and a link to where you can buy tickets. The Facebook address is facebook.com/SundayJewishRadio. Still to come on this week's programme will be this week's roundtable. Clive and Adam will be joined by Tony Honigberg and Andrea Lucas. But just before that, a reminder that we have got a big announcement still to come here on this week's edition of Sunday Jewish Radio. We'll deliver that to you towards the end of the programme, so please do stick with us for that. Of course, we've also got our rabbinic reflection still to come from Rabbi Aaron Goldstein of Pinner and Northwood Liberal Synagogue.
You're listening to Sunday Jewish Radio on Spectrum Radio. It's now time for this week's roundtable. I'm Clive Roslin, and joining Adam Bradley and me this week are volunteer extraordinaire Andrea Lucas and actor and photographer Tony Honigberg. The subject is based on the horrible events in Paris just over a week ago, in which so-called Islamic State terrorists killed 129 innocent people and injured hundreds more. The question we're going to try and unpick on this roundtable is this. Why is it that when the French retaliate, some might say quite rightly, to terror, the world appears to support it? But how come when Israel does, the world seems to condemn it? a big question and a lot to be discussed. So, Tony, let's start with you.
Why do they condemn Israel because, and not France, because the French aren't Jewish?
Well, and some French are Jewish.
Well, some are.
But the round table for this week.
I've answered the question. Yeah. I mean, the French, in the main, they are Jewish. French Jews, of course there are. But the people that are going in are not mainly Jewish. Israelis are Jewish as a nation. And let's be honest about this. I believe that the world hates us. And we will be condemned for whatever we do.
Hates Jews or hates Israelis?
Jews.
Do you really believe?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Andrew, you agree, do you?
I agree.
Why?
Totally. Because if you think about France, it's one of the most anti-Semitic countries that are going, apart from the Eastern Bloc, some of the Eastern Bloc, not all of them. That's why so many Jews are leaving and going to Israel.
Well, it is in fact true that France in the Second World War is... apparently it was worse towards the Jews than the Nazis who'd taken over the country. So I have heard that quite often, but it can't just be that.
Although what Andy says is right, Netanyahu is giving support to the French because of what's happened in France on that Friday.
Well, so he should.
Yeah.
I kind of have to disagree somewhat with you both. I think there is anti-Semitism is rife across the world. We all know that. I don't think the whole world's anti-Semitic. I think there are some, thank God, there are many people who support and actually get us Jews and understand that we are generally a peaceful, peace-loving race. And there are supporters of us. To actually generalise and say the whole world's anti-Semitic, I find it a bit uncomfortable. And I don't actually think that the response the world has given to France responding to terror, I don't think this is an anti-Semitic thing. I actually think when you take yourself out of the Jewish perspective, you've got to look at Israel as a country and you look at France as a country. France are not occupying, let's call it, any land. They don't have any, as the world would see, oppressed culture within their country.
It's always been
free,
France.
Yeah, exactly. It's always been France, and there's no argument about who should be there, who shouldn't, the way that they're treating certain parts of their society. Whereas with Israel, it's such a young country. It's such a country that's still learning who they are themselves, almost. And on the back of this, they've got all these countries surrounding them that want to destroy them, as we know. But then you've got the West Bank, you've got Gaza. It's a very, very different situation
all the
to France.
All the countries that surround Israel are also relatively new countries. You take Iraq, let's take Syria. Let's take Jordan. They're all relatively made-up countries.
But the people have always been living there.
The people have been there from the beginning.
Not as Jordanians and not as Iraqis and not as Syrians.
They were still Arab.
There's no displacement of people.
But there's still Jewish people there.
But there's no displacement of people to set up Iraq. Iraq was there.
And they just redrew the borders.
Exactly. Whereas with Israel, they displaced a lot of people to let the Jews in there. That's where I think a lot of problems are.
This is the whole point. You see, people in this country and in the whole of Europe and perhaps the world remember the Second World War, in which France and Poland and many other countries in Europe were occupied by the Nazis. Mm. Now, nobody's saying, I don't think any even anti-Israel people are saying that the Israelis are Nazis, but they're saying that Israel is occupying
Palestine. A land. Yes.
A land. Mm. And they think that is wrong. And that's what's behind it.
And people don't see, we do, I certainly do, people don't see the rockets fired from Gaza, the attacks, the murders, the stabbings, the car rammings. They don't see it.
I wonder
it's
whether terrorism. They, whether they, no, they it's don't see it as terrorism. They see it and ignore it.
As freedom fighting. Mm.
Yeah. And also, we've said this many times, in fact, I think we said it in last week's roundtable, the Israelis have the worst possible PR in the world.
Oh, we've discussed this often, haven't we? Yes.
Yeah, that is the big problem.
So I think you're wrong to say the whole world is anti-Semitic.
I think the whole world is that. I'm not saying everybody in the whole world is anti-Semitic, but I think if you go to every country in the world, you will find an element of anti-Semitism.
On the other hand, you may be right, because I've been told today that a lot of people are saying that Israel was behind what happened.
Yeah, that came out very quickly, didn't it?
Didn't it just? I just think people who say that just are so ignorant it isn't true. The Israelis and the Jews would certainly not do anything that would really sort of, they don't go around beheading people, they don't go around murdering people unless they've done something to us first. And as far as Israel's concerned, the Jews have been in Israel since time immemorial. That you, all you've got to do is look at the Bible. The Jews were there.
And they
got on very well with whoever else was there, with their Arab neighbours. It was only in 1948, when there was partition, that it changed.
But it didn't change for everybody. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of Israeli Muslim Arabs who say they wouldn't live anywhere else, and they're happy to be in Israel. Their parents or grandparents didn't leave in 1948 because the Arab land said that the Jews coming in will murder you all. They stayed, sure. And they've got jobs and they're educated, etc., etc., etc.
But then you look at during the war, or actually just before the Second World War, as was in the Jewish press quite recently, last couple of weeks, with the Mufti of Jerusalem, and how he spoke to Hitler and was quite keen on, get wipe them out. So this isn't a new feeling purely of the petition.
But that in itself is a strange story, because the Mufti was very anti-Jewish. They say that it was the Mufti's idea that Hitler should get rid of the Jews and kill them, and that Hitler hadn't thought of that at all, according to
that. Well, I'm not sure about that one either.
It was more he encouraged Hitler to go along with his plan.
He said,
what
you're doing is quite a good idea, I think.
Going back to the point about anti-Semitism, there was a report recently in England where over 30% of people surveyed said, they have certain racist thoughts and elements to them. So I don't really, again, I don't think it's necessarily a anti-Semitic thing. I think people in general, even those that don't like to think they are,
have some sort of racist element.
Yeah. I mean, it's just stereotyping. It's just, we all fall into that trap.
I think England's gone through that in the 50s when the West Indians arrived, the Irish arrived, the Jews were here. When Jews arrived, when the Indians arrived, the Pakistanis arrived, there was always an element, wasn't there?
Yeah. And even now with UKIP, some people see that as, they're racist, they just don't want anyone in. And from any other country. Yeah. But it's so much more complex than that. There are certain racist elements that some people might feel, but at the same time, it's looking out for your own. So, I think the problem is that right-wing politics is quite strong in quite a lot of Western countries now because of what's going on, because of the mass immigration. Look at France. Their opposition is the right wing. I mean, that's quite serious. Mm. Le Pen is their opposition. It's not even like the third or fourth.
No, they're now the second party, aren't they?
It's now the second party. But isn't that it's Marie Le Pen, who is not as bad as her father was. She sort of come away. She's said that she doesn't agree with what her father said. So
all this has come about since the world has had this Islamophobia problem, hasn't it?
Yes.
Everywhere in the world. You've got the Dutch guy, whose name I can't quite remember. Again, his party is really strong in Holland. Mm. Sweden have got a problem. Mm. Denmark has got a problem. Germany's got a problem. I mean, this week, Germany were taking lots of immigrants in, and now they've got a problem. They're saying we've got to do something about the borders. Mm. You know.
Well, that's because of what's happened in Paris, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. Whoever thought open borders would work? I didn't. You know, how could it?
But Islamophobia is something that apparently Daesh, ISIS, IL, whatever you want to call them. I know what I want to call them, but it's none of them.
It's not polite.
It's not. No, they apparently part of what they want to do is create Islamophobia.
Yes.
And we're all falling into that trap.
We are.
Far too easily. We all stereotype and generalise far too often. For example, to say the whole world is anti-Semitic, I think that's a dangerous trap we're falling into, in the same way that to say I'm an Islamophobe is it's another generalisation that can only cause problems.
But the two things go hand in hand, because basically Semitism or Semitic people are people that come from the Arab countries.
Yep.
So they are also Semitic people. Mm. So there's a dichotomy there, isn't it? It's really odd.
It has got labelled to Jewish people, hasn't it? Rather than the whole area.
Yeah. And it is actually the whole area that is a Semitic area.
Mm.
The whole thing is crazy, but...
It's funny, though, being Jewish, I almost sometimes feel that I should embrace Islamophobia, but I don't like it.
No.
I really don't. I just feel anything like that is so dangerous.
But is that because you get some Muslims, and I saw a video today about, I think they're called Sharia for Brussels or something like that, that they talk about taking over the world. Mm. And I think then, you know, your defences come up and say, yeah, this can't be right.
Yeah.
Jews never talked about taking over the world.
No, they just did it.
But the majority of Muslims in this country are law-abiding, yes, quite nice, good people.
In the world, it's the minority that have got the problem. What I get disheartened about, and I must give a tick to the French Muslim community who stood up and condemned what happened.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm pretty sure I've read, since this horrible event in Paris, I think I have read of British Muslims saying...
Some Muslims in Luton, yes, got together and, yes, and stood
it has
up
happened there. More, but again, that throws up another issue of criticising your own. Now, I've tossed and turned with this issue about moderate Muslims standing against it. But then you've got to put yourself in almost in the Jewish perspective. When somebody speaks out against Israel, Judaism, and I will mention a name, Gerald Kaufman, he's entitled to his opinion. You can't take that away from him. You agree with it or not. And I expect most of us don't.
Most Jews don't.
But what happened when he criticised Israel? The community were up in arms.
Yeah.
How could you do this? I think there's a degree of that for the moderate Muslims. I think it's very hard. Look at the bad press that Islam is getting at the moment. It's scary. And if I was Muslim at the moment, I'd be pretty scared of how I'm being reflected.
I don't want to get rid of free speech, freedom of speech, because I think that's absolutely necessary. And we've discussed this before on Roundtable about freedom of speech. And I wouldn't want to get rid of that. For the one reason is, if someone opens up their thoughts, you can deal with it. If someone's hiding their thoughts, you can't deal with it because you don't know about them. But I still think people should stand up and say they're probably worried about their families, you know.
What's going to happen if, God forbid, but it looks very much like it. I mean, Boris Johnson has said that we are now at war with ISIS. Mm. And what's going to happen if there's another event? Please God, it doesn't happen, but there's another event like the one in Paris, in this country or in any other part of Europe, or in France again, then there's going to be even more hatred against the Muslims, and that's a time when everybody's got to stand up and say, it's only one small part of Islam that is behaving like this.
Yes.
But as Jews, we should try.
We should stand up and support. Yes. I agree with you.
But it is that one small part of Islam, the radical people. It's a bit like having the radical Jews, really.
Exactly.
They are causing the problem for everybody else.
Yes.
You know, I know that in a lot of synagogues, they have a lot of interaction with the mosques in their area. And they come to visit us, we go to visit them. And, you know, that's how it should be.
I think there was something in the news or in the newspaper review today.
In the newspaper review today.
About the East London mosque is buying the synagogue that's attached to it.
Yes. And
really?
And the Muslims are going to. We did it on the press report today in today's programme, which many people probably heard. The Muslims are going to make this into a mosque, but at the same time, a centre for Jews and Muslims to get together and to
discuss,
work together and live together.
Which is what we need more of.
Which is
we do. We need more dialogue. Yeah. There's definitely
yes.
The
dialogue.
World needs more dialogue.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
But in the meantime, there's a great deal of worry.
Especially the fact that if we do create this Islamophobia, we are playing into their hands, because then tensions rise between the Muslim community and, let's face it, all other communities. Mm. It's far more chance of radicalising Muslims that are being hated by the rest of their society, and we're creating bigger problems.
Do you think then, as Jews, we should make the first move?
Well,
as a Jewish community?
I was speaking recently to Holocaust survivor Freddie Noller, and I was interviewing him for something, and he said one of the most incredible things I've ever heard. This guy has had a very tough life. He went through Auschwitz, and he said, "I don't hate anyone." And if he doesn't hate anyone...
Yeah, why should the rest of us?
Why should we? Yeah. And he's so right, because hate's such a destructive emotion. And this is what we're going to cause. And this is what Daesh are trying to do. They're trying to create hate around the world.
Yeah, divide and...
And I won't let them win.
No, no.
I really won't.
Well, I think that's a very good point at which to end this discussion. And thank you all very much indeed. My grateful thanks to our guests, volunteer extraordinaire Andrea Lucas and actor and photographer Tony Honigberg. Now it's time for our weekly rabbinic reflection, and today it comes from Rabbi Aaron Goldstein from Northwood and Pinner Liberal Synagogue.
One of the questions that Jews have troubled themselves with over millennia is, what does God want of us? Normally we're not very sure, actually, and so we've created a wonderful system around us to be able to answer that question. Of course, some people may say we've been instructed it, and others would say that we've come up with the concepts ourselves, but we've got prayer, we've got learning, we've got celebrating time in a year and throughout a life. So we've written prayers, received a holy scripture that has defined our lives. But of course, we must also think about the way we live our lives, through being good people. We have never needed Mitzvah Day more than at a time when we are still reeling from the atrocities in Paris. The horrid nature of humanity, what it can achieve, really frightens us. And so today brings real light to the world. Of course, I hope that you will continue to listen to the end of this programme. But then, if you've not already done so, get out and do a mitzvah with the Jewish community. With my own community in Northwood, we are doing our own little bit of trying to change the world. We are welcoming a detainee, someone who was held in detention in this country for months on end, and also Hans Fritz, a 96-year-old German Jew, who in the 1940s was interned, detained, on the Isle of Man. Detention is a real blight to our world and our society. Seeing the pictures of refugees moves us to want to do something. And so we're trying to do something just a little bit. And not just us, but by working with all the churches in Northwood and a centre, an Islamic centre in Wickham, a place where a number of ISIS fighters have originated from. We are trying to reach out to that community, to work with them, to bring peace, not just in our country, not just for our people, but for everywhere. I think that's a little bit of what God wants from us.
Thank you to Rabbi Aaron Goldstein from Northwood and Pinner Liberal Synagogue for this week's rabbinic reflection. Now, just before we end today, I told you earlier on in the programme that we have a big announcement, and so here it is. Some of you may or may not know that next week is, in fact, the last edition of Sunday Jewish Radio. I want to reassure you, though, that this is not the end of Jewish radio at this time on Spectrum Radio. In fact, far from it. From Sunday, the 6th of December, SJR will come to you with a brand new look and sound. Not only will you still get to hear and enjoy all the regular presenters and contributors that you've got to know, but in fact, we'll be introducing some new voices as well. Now, I can't give too many details away this week, but I would urge you to please do join us one last time on next week's show as we look back over the past 3.5 years. Can you believe it's been that long already? And we'll share with you some of our highlights, and you'll also hear full details of what the future holds for our team. And that is Sunday Jewish Radio for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank our guests, Robert Edgeners, Rachel Sage, Andrea Lucas and Tony Honigberg, who are on Roundtable, the team, and of course, you at home for listening. If you've missed any of this show, then you can hear it when, from tomorrow, it's available online on Listen Again. Simply go to spectrumradio.net. And remember, you can now hear the most recent editions of Sunday Jewish Radio at any time as a podcast. You can go to sundayjewishradio.co.uk or search for us in iTunes. Sunday Jewish Radio is an independent production recorded at the studios of Jewish Care in London and is produced by Adam Bradley and Sue Greenberg. I'm Phil Dave from the whole SJR team. Shavua Tov, and make sure you have yourselves a very good week.